This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth. James, today we have a report out which is looking at the government's response to COVID. And in a way, it doesn't make for particularly surprising reading, but the results and the judgment isn't particularly positive for the government.
No, this is the report jointly by the Health and Science Select Committees. It's the one where you remember where Dominic Cummings came and gave evidence, Matt Hancock gave evidence. And I think what it says is the government was basically too late to lock down, which is now very much the conventional wisdom. But, you know, it did well in ordering the vaccines in advance. I think if you'd asked people what they roughly expected the report to say, it would have said that. I think a lot of the drama has been taken out of the report. If you remember, there was that big row between Dominic Cummings and Matt Hancock about who was telling the truth about testing targets. But because Matt Hancock has had to resign for other reasons, I think if Matt Hancock was still the Secretary of State for Health, I mean, there'd be more interest in that section of the report and whose side it takes or doesn't take than there is. I think the interesting question is, why was there this failure? I think the report uses the term phrase failure of imagination to not think that Sally Davis, sorry, that uses the phrase failure of imagination, not to think that a SARS-like virus could end up here. Why, when the UK was so convinced it was well prepared for a pandemic, was it so unprepared for COVID-19? And I think this is a big question. And the report talks about, you know, how we should have kind of scanning, horizon scanning for future threats. That's one of its recommendations, one of its ideas. That is an important thing too. I also think there is an interesting question about resilience. I do think when you look at the UK in general, there is very little resilience in lots of things. I think you saw this with the country running out of petrol the other day. And I think this is something that the country needs to look at, which is, you know, are you prepared to build more redundancy into the system to have more resilience? We operate on a system where the NHS basically has just enough beds for how much it needs. And that's why so often in winter, the NHS essentially runs out of beds. Should we be looking at higher levels? It's expensive, but should we be looking at higher levels of hospital capacity so we have more spare capacity, which would help deal with a situation like this? One of the views as to why Germany did better was because it had more spare hospital beds. So in some ways, you could say a less efficient health system. But that meant that it could take more people into hospital earlier. And that's one of the reasons why I think that the death toll in Germany has proportionately been lower than it has been here. But I don't think there is anything in this report that will particularly surprise, you know, anyone who's been following COVID or particularly cause the government trouble. I think it sits roughly where everyone thinks that the government got wrong, which was too slow to react at the beginning. But, you know, the vaccines were good. I think the other question this raises as well is, we've talked a lot about the failures of the politicians, and there have undoubtedly been failures by the politicians. There is also something else that I think comes out of this report relatively clearly, which is certainly in terms of the early decision about whether to lock down or not and the delay in doing so, the government was basically following the scientific advice. And I think that raises an interesting question about the whole way scientific advice is given to government. Is there enough challenge within that? Has Whitehall created a system where people with difficult views are kind of not on the relevant committees?
And James, you touched on it there, but I think when it comes to, I suppose, the winners and losers in the report, it isn't really a politicians versus scientists.
No.
In the sense that there is the sense that the scientific advice was something the politicians followed. There are flaws with that. One thing I thought on looking over its contents is there does seem to be an argument for more transparency in the sense that there is obviously a delay every time Sage met to get their findings up. And particularly in the early stages, had that been more public early on, there would be more chance for debate. Do you think that's something the government might take from this?
I think one thing worth remembering is, do you remember there was a big debate early on about whether the membership of Sage should be published or not? And in the end, they ended up publishing most of the member people who were on Sage. I think lots of people in government in private regret that decision because it meant that lots of people who were on Sage would then appear on the media and say, well, I think we need this intervention or that intervention. And the government didn't like that because sometimes it didn't want to do that because it was looking at other considerations other than public health. Now, you can argue that the government was wrong to be doing that, but I think it is an interesting question here. But I think I don't see any harm in publishing earlier and more quickly, because I think if you had done that, you might have got more challenge from people saying, well, hang on a second, is this the right response given everything? I also think there is another thing here which is worth thinking about, which is where we all were in 2020. I think there were people who thought we should have locked down earlier, and credit to them. But I also think if the government had announced a kind of complete ban on foreign travel in February 2020, I think lots of people would have said, why are you doing that? You know, that's deeply illiberal, which it obviously is. But I think there is evidence and a case to believe that that would have improved the situation.
Who do you think comes out best from the report, James?
I don't think anyone in the British state comes out well from the
report.
There's
a little bit of praise from Matt Hancock on testing.
Yeah, but I mean, there's enough. He was the health secretary, during which was described as one of the worst public health failures in Britain's history. So I think it's hard to put that one on the CV.
Now, James, elsewhere, the gas crisis rumbles on after the pretty extraordinary briefing over the weekend by a Treasury source against the business secretary, suggesting there are no conversations going on between Treasury and business in terms of a bailout or a support package for those companies struggling with the hike in fuel prices. The business department have now put a proposal through. It suggests that Number 10 backs what's in it, and we're hearing that a package could be announced fairly soon. Is this a climb down in terms of Rishi Sunak and what he's doing, or not so much?
I think one of the big things to look at is what is the devil of this is going to be in the detail. Are these loans that these companies are going to be expected to repay when prices return to more normal levels? Or is this grants? And that, I think, is a big distinction. I think the other question is, how long do you think the gas price is going to remain high? You know, and I don't think anyone expects it to remain this high indefinitely. Boris Johnson famously said on that flight to New York for the owner and assembly, you regarded these price increases as temporary. I mean, there is quite a good case for thinking that even if some of the price comes off, that we are moving to an era where gas prices are structurally higher. I mean, there are three reasons for that. Firstly, countries are trying to move away from coal, and so that increases the demand for natural gas. You know, I think I was reading the other day that every year almost 15 million households in China get connected to the gas grid. Secondly, Europe's own gas supplies have dropped by about 30% in the last 10 years. You know, lots of the fields that Europe were exploiting are not producing as much gas as they once were. And thirdly, I think you will see Russia using the gas price as a political tool. Russia is looking at building pipelines so that by 2030, not only Nord Stream 2, but by 2030, Russia will be able to decide whether to send gas from certain fields that at the moment only supply Europe. It'll be able to make a decision about whether to send that gas to either to China or to Europe. So I think we are probably moving into an era where gas prices are structurally higher. The question then becomes, do some of these energy intensive industries, do they work with gas prices and energy prices in general higher in a structural sense? I mean, that's one of the other big questions to ask. And then I mean, the other question, which is something you were talking about on the radio yesterday, Katie, which is an interesting point, is look at this firm with the two factories that produce 60% of the UK CO2. You know, it is sometimes it is actually possible to get people purchasing the product to pay more because they exist in a profitable sector. They actually need this product, so they are prepared to pay higher prices. So there isn't actually a need for the state to step in. What you need is to just simply pass that cost on to the purchaser. Now, obviously that is going to contribute to the inflationary pressures that we see in the system. But I think that, you know, I think passing the carbon dioxide manufacturers passing the prices on to supermarkets is preferable to having the state step in.
And it's interesting on that, James, just in the sense that it does feel as though Rishi Sunak might be in a fairly small group, or at least in the minority when it comes to those in cabinet making these arguments, with a sense that I think that beyond just the business secretary, that there is a difficulty moving from obviously the emergency COVID period, where there was just a general sense that, you know, the state would move in, it was exceptional times, to what I think the Treasury now seen as almost a back to normal, where you want to move away from that. And I think it's probably going to be a very difficult autumn for Rishi Sunak in terms of landing that message, particularly when we're hearing that number 10 today suggesting, you know, stepping behind the business secretary, the comments yesterday backing him up, and you know, somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to kind of read out my column in the coming issue of the magazine because I'm not sure everyone's relieved, but I think if you look at this, right, during COVID was like a war in terms of what the state did. You know, it told you who you could and couldn't invite into your home. It spent £60 billion, or up more than £60 billion, paying the wages of private sector workers. These are interventions in social life and in economic life that are unprecedented in peacetime. After the state does things like this, it very rarely goes back to its original pre-crisis size. You know, World War II was followed by the Attlee-era nationalisations, the creation of the NHS and the modern welfare state. You know, after World War I, Lloyd George extended unemployment insurance, introduced rent controls, fixed wages for farm labourers. You know, the state doesn't shrink back to the size that it previously was. Now, I think one of the arguments you are seeing in government is, should the state shrink back to that previous size, which I think is the pre-crisis size, which is pretty much the Treasury view, or are we comfortable with a much bigger, much more active, much more interventionist state? And at the moment, the Department of Business seems to be there, and number 10 seems to be more inclined to, at least for a little while, continue with this bigger, more active, more interventionist state, rather than going back to a kind of pre-crisis sized state with a pre-crisis sized approach to questions about intervention in the economy.
Thank you, James, and thank you for listening.